Good morning. It's great to be together. We're starting a new series this week for the next 3-4 weeks. It'll be on the big question of what happens after this life. Now, some of you will be aware of this, but we've spent some time surveying around our friends and relatives, family and so on, workmates, what they thought the answers to that question were. And we've got four. And so we're going to be dealing with each of those over the next couple of weeks. Today is on the topic of reincarnation. This came in third. So the third most popular response was, after this life, we believe that we'll be reincarnated. And next week was the second most popular. It was the answer, after life, there is nothing. It just ceases to exist. We'll deal with that next week. The first most popular answer, so you can see we're doing it in reverse order, the first most popular answer was the one, we believe there's a heaven but not a hell. We'll consider that in 3 weeks' time. And equal with this week is the fourth one, which was, we're not sure and we don't know how you could know, but we'd like to think there's something. So we'll come to that in a few weeks' time. And what are the evidences? Can you know what's after this life? So it's a great series to be going through, and we'd love to encourage you to keep coming along and build up the picture as we go along. Invite your friends. There might be people you think it particularly is relevant for. Get them along as well. Today we're going to deal with reincarnation. Now, it's quite a topic. I'm going to actually ask God, that I believe exists, to help us in this. So if you are in the practice of praying, then join me. But if not, listen in and I'll pray for us on our behalf. Let's do that. Our great God, we do come before you this morning asking, please, that if you are there, that you might reveal yourself. Now, we are fully convinced because of the work of Jesus, his person, his death, his resurrection, that you are there. You have promised to reveal yourself, and we pray, please, this morning you might do that through even these frail efforts to express the truth of what you have done. And we ask that you might do it amongst us, please, this morning, in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, reincarnation, that's the topic this morning. But let me engage with it by sharing a story that Jesus told that will appear initially, unless I don't know, you can work it out, but it'll appear initially as if it's got nothing to do with reincarnation. It comes from Luke's account of the life of Jesus. And if you're unaware, Luke's... Now, I'm actually going to ask if we can do this. Can we get up the beginning part of the reading there? We had it on the screen during the time it was read. Let's see if we can pull that off. This, where we're reading from here is Luke's account of Jesus' life. It was written by a man who was a medical doctor in the ancient world, and he used his kind of skills to pull together evidence. And what he did was go around and do the research, talk to people, and gather together all the things that Jesus said and did, and put it together in this account that we have by the name, we call it Luke, because it was written by a man called Luke. And he's effectively recorded for us all the eyewitnesses' recollections of Jesus. And one of the recollections that he has for us is that Jesus told this particular story, a story that isn't necessarily true, that is, it didn't happen. But the point was that Jesus was making something of this story that he told to teach us a truth. Let me take you through the story. It's a wonderful one. It's one that people are very familiar with. It's called The Prodigal Son. That's how we know of it. It's a situation where there are two men living at home with their father, and the younger brother says, I want to leave. He ups and leaves home, and he demands his share of the inheritance from his father. Now, that's an extraordinary thing to do because his father's not dead. But effectively what he says is, I don't want you around in my life anymore. I want what's mine that I'd get upon your death. I want it now. The father says, all right, gives it to him. Now, he's called the younger brother. We don't know whether he was himself young. It's possibly the younger brother and still quite old. Although in my family, they do wonder whether I'm the younger one or whether my older brother is actually younger than me because of, I don't know, some suggest I look older than him now. I've been worn through all kinds of circumstances. But you've made me look older than I ought. I'm only 40. Anyway, we don't know whether he's young himself, but it seems a good assumption because if you look there at verse 14, halfway down that little section there, he went and squandered his money on wild living. Now, that suggests a young man, doesn't it? Because if an older man went and spent the inheritance, it would have just been on living. Do you know what I mean? Whereas this guy, he's going on wild living, which suggests a young man. And it seems this young man has left because he was chafing under his father. He wanted freedom, or what we should perhaps say in inverted commas is freedom. He wanted what he thought was freedom. So he went to a distant country, away from the chafing relationship with his father, into a distant country, and now without restraint, without the restraint perhaps of his father's expectations and obligations in the home and so on, he just spent. And he went for it. He lived the way he wanted to live, doing what he wanted to do. He was free, or so it seemed. Now, after a time, his freedom lost its gloss, and you can see that he's now spent everything. There was a severe famine, and he now went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country who then sent him to feed the figs and so on, and he lived in that context. He's now lost everything. The freedom that he pursued has lost its gloss, and he's living with the consequences of those choices. Jesus says at this point, and if we slide on to the next one, I think that'll give it to us, when he came to his senses, he said, "How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare, and here I am starving to death?" Here's a man who comes to his senses. He realizes, it's verse 17 if you're looking at your Bibles, he's come to his senses and realized, "I was better off back home than I am here." Now that's a big thing to do, isn't it? It's not easy to come to your senses. It's not easy to actually be in a context and situation where you've made choices and run down a certain path. It's not easy to get to some point down that path and go, "I've made a mistake. This is wrong. I need to go back." Now look at the way he goes back. He goes back determined to say, verse 18 or a little bit down through there, he says, "I'm no longer worthy to be..." Well, actually prior to that, he says, "I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired men.'" Now that is swallowing your pride, isn't it? Very humbling. He is determined to go back and acknowledge his mistakes and say, "I'm sorry. I'm just happy now to be a nobody and a nothing." Now, that's the kind of response I think we'd all pray our 18-year-old children gave at some point through our lives, isn't it? That they would come back like that. It's not easy for an 18-year-old. It's not. I haven't got an 18-year-old. That's why it's safe to say that. They are either side of that. But it's not easy when you're a 35-year-old. Not easy when you're 40. Not easy when you're 50, 60. That I've been living one way, understanding things one way, and I realise now I've been wrong. It takes a great deal of humility. This man determines to go home. But what he finds when he gets home is a great surprise. And you can see at that bottom paragraph there, "While he was still a long way off, his father saw him, was filled with compassion for him, ran to his son, threw his arms around him and kissed him." And then, slide over to the next, the son goes through his rehearsed speech, "Father, I've sinned against heaven, against you, I'm no longer worthy to be called your son." But look at the way the next little thing, it starts with the word "but." "But the father says to his servants, 'Quick, bring the best robe, put it on him, put a ring on his fingers, sandal on his feet, bring the fatted calf, kill it, let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead, he is alive again, he was lost, he is found.' So they began to celebrate." That's not what he expected when he went home. He found the father to be very different from what he thought he would be like. And he found when he came home, there was not out the back and work. "Pay for your terrible mistakes. You've offended me and you need to now pay for it." There was none of that. It was welcome back. Celebrate, rejoice, part of the family. Extraordinary response. Now, it's a powerful story. And it was told, dare I say it, for a very different reason than engaging with reincarnation. I don't think it was on Jesus' mind when he told the story to be dealing with the topic of reincarnation. There's no verse that says here, so you can see how this will help you thinking about reincarnation. That's not there. It's worth pointing out that it was actually told by Jesus for a different purpose. It was told to have a dig at the religious leaders. You can see that at the very beginning of the chapter that this passage fits in. Chapter 15, verse 1 and 2, Jesus tells all of these stories to engage with the whole issue of the hypocrisy and hard, cold-heartedness of religious people, which is a very great warning. It is possible as a religious person, as a churchgoer, to become quite self-righteous, to look down at others, to think you're better than, That's the ones that Jesus had in his sights when he told this story. And so the older brother that we don't look at this morning, but the older brother is the key, actually, to this whole story. It's a powerful story, but it does apply to this issue of reincarnation. Now, how? Well, let me show you. Reincarnation, especially in its Western guise, is driven by many of the same instincts that drove that son to leave home. And I'll show you what I mean by that by unpacking what reincarnation is about. Here we go. There are two, for our purposes this morning, there are two basic forms of reincarnation. There's the religious package of reincarnation, or religious package within which reincarnation fits. And then there's its Western guise within which you see reincarnation sit. Now, within its religious package, there are many different forms. There's slight nuances to reincarnation. Within Buddhism, it's different to Hinduism, within Jainism and so on. There's all kinds of different religious structures and shapes. But for our purposes this morning, I just want to draw your attention to those two broad categories of the religious kind and the Western kind, its Western guise, which we most likely engage with. In its religious kind, which you see in Buddhism and Hinduism and so on and so forth, reincarnation is driven by pessimism. It's driven by pessimism. It's driven by the problem of suffering in life and a desire to get out of that suffering, a desire to get off the wheel of life. Let me explain that. So in the religious package of which reincarnation sits within its Eastern form, it fits within four aspects of a worldview that operates. The first aspect of that is that reincarnation sits within a concept of an understanding of life which is a unity. Everything's one. All of life is one. We're all interconnected. Every form of life is of a piece. It's called the great cosmic force, or Brahman, in those kind of Eastern religions. There's the first thing. The unity of everything is part of this worldview. The second aspect is that human life is part of that unity, part of that wholeness, but it's a dislocated part. It's a dislocated part. Life in this worldview is one, but humans live dislocated from that oneness in the same way that a spark fires out from a fire. So the fire is the cosmic oneness that shoots off a spark, and a human life is like that spark. Or it's like the ocean is the oneness and a rock has dropped in and splashed out drops. Each human life is a separate drop. But we are of the same stuff with the fire or with the ocean, depending on which picture you want to use. And we are of the same stuff, of the same kind, but dislocated from it. Thirdly, so unity of everything, human life is just a dislocated dimension of that unity. Thirdly, it's karma that is the power that has separated us and keeps us separated. Well, roughly put, that is, karma is the law of cause and effect. You do good, you will attract good. You do bad, you'll attract bad. You reap what you sow. There's an absolute necessity to the consequences of every choice you make. You do bad things, it'll bring, and so on and so forth. There's karma. Now, the karma is understood slightly differently in, say, Buddhism as it is to Hinduism, and I will touch on that in a moment. And if you're interested in chasing Buddhism and Hinduism up a little further, I mean, you can, of course, do all kinds of searches on the internet and so on, but if you're interested from a Christian perspective, certainly we've done some talks here on Buddhism and Hinduism in past January series, and if you want to chase that up, you can find them on the internet at our website. But the problem is that humans have attracted to themselves bad karma, which holds us apart from the universe as a whole. So the reason the spark of my life is separated from the eternal flame, or the drop is separated from the ocean of the cosmos and its life, is because of negative karma that's attracted to my life, which holds me there, into, and it holds and forces me into this wheel of life where there's this endless cycle of birth, suffering, death, rebirth, suffering, death, endlessly cycling on and on. And the reason I'm bound to this wheel of suffering and death and suffering and rebirth, death, is because of karma. Fourth thing, the purpose of life in this religious conception within which reincarnation sits, the purpose of life is to escape that wheel and merge back again with the ocean, with the fire, with the cosmos, back in unity with all things. Now, there's a quick run through, but do you see the pessimism that kind of filters through it all, that infiltrates the whole of this conception? It's a pessimism because the aim of reincarnation within this whole worldview is to escape life. It's to get off the wheel of life. It's to make this life the last life so that I'm out of it and I'm united back. Now, by contrast, Western reincarnation is driven by optimism. It's driven by optimism. Now, Western reincarnation, the view of reincarnation in the West is very popular, surprisingly popular. As I said, this is the third most popular response, but we got 15% of the people we spoke to gave this as their answer to what happens after this life. We're reincarnated. It's on the Central Coast. It's a somewhat popular view. Across the country, 27% of Australians would say they believe in reincarnation. That's one in every four. That's quite a group of people. Now, it's not the most popular response, as I say, we'll come to that in a few weeks' time, but it is quite a substantial group in our society. And I want to suggest that in the Western world, the impulse that's led us to reincarnation, now this may not be the case for every single individual, but I'm happy to hear, but my take on it is that it's been optimism that's driven us in this direction. There's a few things. Let me see if I can take you through three. It's the eternality of life, which is just a really flash way of saying we feel like life's eternal. Okay, so the eternality of life, the life that's eternal, that's compelled many to a view of reincarnation. Let me explain that. We've lived at a time in the West where materialism has left us with a very arid landscape. We've been told by the sciences that life is nothing more than a complex array that can be explained by biology, physics, chemistry. You know, all you are is the complex combining of physical component parts that create everything about you. And so you can be entirely reduced to just matter. And your mind, your affections, your feelings, all of that is merely the firing of chemical reactions and in your brain, and that's all you are. And so when your body ends, everything about you ends because you're only physical. Now that's created for many of us a very arid landscape. And for most of us, and we'll deal with this more next week, but for most of us, we feel it's very inadequate. We look out from our heads, as you're all doing, and we see the world out there and we see something within us looking out going, I'm just a big machine, and who I am and how I think about myself is just matter. There's something about me, this life, this self-consciousness, this awareness that doesn't just feel like it's physical firings of a big computer. Am I right? There's something about my life force that feels bigger than the physical environment and circumstance of my body. Well, that sense, which I think is actually built into us by God, you get in the book of Ecclesiastes, which is in the Old Testament, chapter 3, verse 11, it says, God has put eternity in the heart of man. There is this sense of something more about us that is an experience for all. I take it God has put it there, but we have this. And so we look out on Western materialism and we go, no, that can't be the answer. There's got to be more. This life can't be enough. And death can't be the end to my life. In fact, listen to the words of a reincarnationist himself who made this comment. Quote, "This variety of life, where did it come from? It would be utterly meaningless if we appeared on this earth for one short earth life and then vanished. Got to be more, you see. One life is utterly insufficient to produce the purpose of the cosmic mind. Who are we? With wonderful powers of feelings and ethical justice that so often go against selfishness. There's divinity in this, a divine spark, divine harmony and cosmic intelligence." End quote. So you can see the instinct. And none of this is a critique. This is just sharing how I think people, we have this sense of there's got to be more, there's more than the physical, there's more than just surely one life is too, there's got to be something beyond. And so the concept of coming back again, that it fits so neatly. So eternality of the soul. But also there's a second thing that I think compels Westerners to this path, and that is, if you've noticed, if you would have picked up in the quote, and I won't go back through it again, but the quote also talked about divine justice. There is for many of us a sense that life is unfair, that suffering is lumpy. That is to say, some people get lots of it and others get not much. It's lumpy. So the man who gets married, has a child who dies, and then has another child who's diagnosed with cancer, then has another child with Down syndrome, and then has his wife die while the kids are still in very young age, and then he himself is diagnosed with cancer and loses, and all the medication that he's given actually causes massive reactions, then he loses his job, and there's one man's life, and there's another man's life whose grandparents and parents are still alive, all his kids are married happily, and he's got a great job. You know, what's going on here? That's not fair, do you see? We notice that lumpiness to suffering. Well, reincarnation suggests an answer. It says it's lumpy because of past lives. The reason one attracts more suffering than another is because of their past lives. It explains the problem. And it offers progress, it says, but that's okay because if your circumstances are dreadful now, you'll have another life and then another life to grow and develop and improve. Do you see what I'm suggesting here is the optimism? What compels the Westerner to reincarnation isn't the desire to get off life and out of suffering and make this to your last one. It's actually the impulse to have more life, to experience more, to grow more, to develop more, do you see? I'd suggest there's one more thing that compels us towards, makes evolution, reincarnation attractive, which ties us now in with the prodigal son. I think it's driven also by a desire to be free from constraint, free from external constraint, free from a God outside of us, over us, to whom we're accountable. So the impulse that leads me with this sense that there's got to be more, life is bigger than just one life, the sense that there's got to be an answer to justice and injustice, the sense that drives me into reincarnation instead of into the arms of a God is because I want to actually be in a place where I don't have to live under him, where I can be free. Reincarnation is attractive because it leaves me accountable only to me. I don't have to answer to anyone else outside of me. If my life goes well, it's because of me. If it goes badly, it's because of me. It's my life to live as I choose. I did it my way. It's my life. And the idea of a personal being outside of us who might be over us, to whom we might be accountable, who might judge us, is constraining, limiting, crushing, squashing, oppressive. And so we don't want that. Now, here's the thing. I want to suggest to you this morning that the distant land that we have gone to in our desire to find resolution for the sense of eternalness about us and the sense of the need for justice and the sense of freedom, The distant land that all of that has taken us to isn't all that it seems. And in addition, I want to say that the home that we've left, the home of relationship with a personal God, the God of the Bible, is very much more wonderful than we thought it was. Let me take you through each of those. The distant land that we've gone to as Westerners. Reincarnation appears to answer these issues of the eternality of the soul, the eternal character of life and the need for justice and dealing with injustice. It seems to answer all of these and the need for freedom. But when you dig in, it's actually very much different than you thought. You may have thought. It's different from the way many people have thought. You see, let me take each of them. The eternal nature of life, the sense that there must be more. One life is too little. The universe is too large to only experience it for this short time. There's the Westerner impulse. I get the drive for that. The Bible, I suggest to you, says it's there because God's put it there. But it's ill-considered to think reincarnation and Eastern religions are the answer to it. Let me explain why. In the Eastern religion, conception of reincarnation, not the Western one yet, but in the Eastern religious conception of reincarnation, it isn't the self that lasts. It is merely a life force stripped of your self-conscious personality that lasts. Now, in Hinduism, there is the belief that you do have a soul and your soul will rebirth into another person. But your soul that's reborn will be reborn into another person. It won't be you. Buddhism takes it further. Buddha actually thought Hinduism hadn't gone far enough, hadn't thought through things far enough. And he taught very clearly that humans don't have a soul. In fact, humans aren't individuals at all. There is nothing that is you or me. We are just bundles of sensations. And let me give you a statement from their writings. Quote, nirvana is, that is the end point of oneness again with the cosmos, nirvana is, but not the man who seeks it. The path exists, but not the traveler on it. All is an illusion. And part of enlightenment for the Buddhist is actually coming to the appreciation that my sense of personal identity and the reality of me is an illusion. I've been wrong. I don't actually exist. Now, which means the trek by many Westerners into the East and Eastern religions is very ironic. Because as the Westerner travels on his journey of self-fulfillment, he finds himself in the East, and if he goes far enough in that distant land, he will end up taking on fully the fact that there is no self to fulfill. You see. Now, there's something of the theory, but listen to an account, or at least some recollection of an account by a man who grew up in a family of Hindus who were pursuing this very thing. It's written in a book, and it's an old book that it's worth chasing down. In fact, I'm going to chase it down again, because I've lent it to someone, and one of you has it and won't give it back to me. It's called Death of a Guru, and it's very old. You can get it off, I'm sure, off Amazon for probably 80 cents, but the delivery will cost you $50. But it's a very good book. But this man grew up in the highest Hindu caste, the Brahmin caste, and his father was a major guru in that context, pursuing enlightenment and pursuing union with the cosmic, with nirvana. And he'd been in a trance for 8 years pursuing this deeper path. One of the paths for Buddhism is the path, the duty of reflection. And so he'd gone down this path, and he hadn't spoken a word to his sons or his wife for 8 years. And as he reflected on that as the ultimate goal, the cessation of relationship and the ending of relationship, he began to become disenchanted and be driven to actually reflect further. What really is the answer? Where is the hope truly to be found? And it helped him move towards reflecting on the Christian faith and the words of Jesus. After his father's death, he then lost his mother to meditation as well. She retreated from as she pursued enlightenment. There is the reality of the experience as you go down this path. Now, even for the, there's the religious conception of it, but even for the modern Westerner who embraces some dimensions of the reincarnation theology and thinking, just reflect with me on this for a moment. If this life is one of many, and you've embraced the concept of reincarnation in your optimistic desire to have an ongoing experience of life and to have an enrichment that one life can't possibly sustain, if that is your path and pursuit, the fact is, friends, that you are totally unaware of the richness of your previous lives, of which this is the last one in that line. So if you've pursued reincarnation to actually, my life must be richer and fuller, you won't even know it or actually experience it. Now, there are some who insist on recovered memories, but the science of this is fraught, and there's much difficulty in appreciating the evidence for it, and it's rarely experienced anyway, which leaves many eventually in this distant land, having pursued a sense that there must be more, having pursued the sense of desire for justice and freedom. It leaves many, though, after a time in this distant land, very disillusioned and dissatisfied. Let me give you one example. A woman on the Central Coast, actually, whose husband, she was committed to the concept of reincarnation and so on, felt it gave much hope and confidence for the future. Her husband died not too long ago, and in the midst of the sense that this would give me great comfort, as she thought further into it, she became very disillusioned, because my husband died and there was comfort and hope in the possibility that his life might live on, just not as my husband. You see, so that the life that lives on won't be the man who died that I will ever know again. And so, for to me, he is gone. And she was left in grief. It's important to get this, friends, because we do see and hear of the Hindu traditions of funerals and so on that are presented to us by Western media as very hopeful. And there is a great sense of hope. They dress in white, not black, we're told. They are dressing in white, not black, but the point is made by the Westerner that you see how this is much more positive than the Western funeral in black. It's a positive experience, except the reality is, as you think into it, we look on, we're drawn into the positivism, the beauty of it and so on, but if the soul lives on, it's not the soul of the 20-year-old son that died tragically. And so, yes, we have hope for a life force that might continue. It's just, I will never know my son again. He is gone, gone forever. None of this is saying that reincarnation is false. You notice that? I've not said that. I've not engaged with it at that level yet. In fact, I won't touch on that much until the next few weeks. It's merely to note that it isn't what it promises. Now, you pick up the other issue of fairness. This is one thing that makes it very appealing to many, that it gives an answer to the problem of injustice in our world. But when you think deeper about it or live longer in this distant land, in our desire to find this freedom, this dealing with injustice and so on, it becomes a very different conception of justice than the one we've actually been drawn to. Suffering is explained in these worldviews as the necessary rule of cause and effect. All suffering, we're told, and pain is a consequence of the payback of the universal law of karma. That is, if you are suffering now, it will be because of some personal evil prior in your life or in a previous life, which seems fair and just and seems to explain your circumstances. But think a moment longer with me for it. The young 13-year-old girl who is raped by leaders that she ought to have trusted in some religious institution and is shattered and destroyed by the experience, we are told by the reincarnation worldview that she only has herself to blame, because it's her karma that has attracted to her this event. She is suffering in this as a necessary payback from evil that must have occurred in her past life. Now, is that shocking? Listen to the words. It's so shocking. I actually think we need to see whether it's... Have I just made that up? Listen to the words of an exponent of reincarnation. It's a man called Glenn Hoddle. Now, some people from the earlier services did remember this incident. You might remember this instance. He was the manager of the English soccer team. He was quite a prominent figure. And he was a Hindu. And he expressed his Hindu beliefs in an interview with the London Times newspaper some years ago. And he said these words, let me quote, "You and I have been physically given two hands and two legs and a half-decent brain. Some people have not been born like that for a reason. The karma is working from another lifetime. I have nothing to hide about that. It is not only people with disabilities. What you sow, you have to reap." Now, I'm not sure of your reaction, but England was outraged. It went all the way up to the Prime Minister and he was sacked. And it went all the way up like that because they were outraged. And do you see why they were outraged? Because they saw the implications of his view and what he was saying, which was the disabled were clearly morally inferior. The disabled were clearly morally inferior. And the healthy and wealthy deserved everything they were getting. Now, I'm told after the earlier service that there's a book that recounts all of this. And apparently, he then went and spoke to the Dalai Lama to see whether he'd done the right thing in expressing his views the way he had. He was assured that he had expressed the views correctly, just that the Dalai Lama said, "We don't talk about that in the Western society because we are not prepared for it," you see. Now, this is the price tag that comes with this particular view. Now, it fails to work too, as I might suggest, at another level. Think with me about Hitler. Hitler killed 6 million Jews, or led the organisations and military that killed 6 million Jews. At the end of his life, he dies by his own hand. He is never brought to justice. Now, for mine, that is a great tragedy. Justice has not been done. Well, the reincarnationist says it will be done because he will get balanced in a future life. He will come back again and will attract to himself now suffering to pay for the suffering he caused others. But please, it won't be as Hitler that he comes back. A baby will be born, Graham Johnson in Erina. And sorry if that happens to be your name this morning. Graham Johnson at Erina is born and finds as a young child that he keeps attracting terrible suffering. He is abused, he's ostracised, he's diseased, bullied. And why? Why is this happening? The answer? You have been born with Hitler's karma. But I didn't do any of that. No, but your life force attracted that to you. But I didn't kill 6 million Jews. Graham as Graham suffers, not Hitler as Hitler. Do you see? Now, life compels us, for the great majority, to see the eternality of who we are. This life isn't enough. And I fully agree. But the answer that we've run to as many Westerners is very much less than we thought it was going to be, delivers less than we thought it was going to deliver. The desire to see justice meted, it doesn't do what we thought it would do. And the desire for freedom just isn't what we've pursued. And I want to suggest that as you run down the path of reincarnation further, it breeds two further hurts, fatalism and pessimism. It breeds fatalism. Suffering is necessary in the reincarnationist view, because to fight against suffering is to fight against the balancing of karma. Eastern religions who embrace most consistently the theology, the theology is a misnomer, the worldview of reincarnation and so on, are very quiet, still people. And Westerners are drawn to that in our frenetic pace and so on of life. There's something peaceful about the Buddhist. Absolutely right. And there's something peaceful about the Buddhists because they've appreciated that every piece of pain and suffering and grief that comes their way, they have attracted, and there's nothing they can do about it. And doing nothing about it will actually facilitate their further balancing of the cosmos. And so there's a great fatalism that comes. And further, there's pessimism. What is my hope that this thing, life force, karma for the Buddhist, soul for the Hindu, this life in me that will in the future go upward and not downward, find greater experiences and not suffering, what hope is there for that? It's me. It's my efforts. It's my work. It's my pursuit of duty. It's my pursuit of reflection. It's my pursuit of life in the particular circle. It's me. And there's nothing in all of this worldview to interrupt the unrelenting spiral down that it's up to me. And it's at this point the Christian faith shines. You see, at this very point, Jesus assures us that he has come from God the Father to break the cycle that we are locked into by our karma, by bad constantly attracting bad. He says he comes to seek and save the lost, Luke chapter 19, verse 10. He comes to offer his life as a ransom for many. He comes extraordinarily, he says, to attract to himself all of our karma, that he might absorb into his own life all that we have done wrong, that we might not have to pay for it because it will be paid for in him, so that there can be a breaking of the cycle, so that it's possible for mercy and forgiveness to come to those that don't deserve it, who need it desperately because there's no other hope if it's up to me. If the future betterment was my being better, I will only ever go down. And Jesus comes saying, I've come to rescue you by the gracious gift of forgiveness of God the Father who loves you and is not the oppressive tyrant that you thought you ought to run from. You see, the prodigal story, son, may be a story, and it was just a story. But in it, Jesus was sharing how he sees our world, that we are prodigals. We have each of us in all kinds of different ways walked away from the true and living God, manufactured gods that would suit us. It's interesting to hear in the testimony, wasn't it? Manufactured gods that would suit the way we want things to be. And we've pushed off this illusion of God or created one in the way we want him to be so that we might gain the freedom we thought we wanted and not have the constraints and oppressive forces of someone outside of us over us all the time. But in fleeing all of that, we've run away from true freedom. And we've now found ourselves in a distant land where the promises and hopes that we had are not returning what we thought they were going to. And the fact I want to draw your attention to this morning is that the God who exists, the God that you see revealed to us in the Bible, the true and living God, who tells us in Hebrews 9 that there is only one life, and after that we face him, the God of this Bible, the true and living God, is very different from what we've been telling ourselves. He's very different from the God that we thought we needed to run from. He's the God who comes searching for us, and he breaks through our ignorance, and he breaks through at some level our own self-deceit, because that's what we have often dealt with, and says, I'm the God, I'm the Father of this story Jesus told. The Father who wants relationship with you is waiting for you to come to your senses and come back and find not a God who will make you work in the back until you paid off all your debts, but a God who will give you freely and graciously what you don't deserve. Mercy, forgiveness, a new life, a relationship with him full of joy and gladness and constraint. It's not the constraint of rules and regulations. It's the constraint of a loving relationship. Every relationship you enter into that's committed brings constraints. That's the nature of love. And to come back to this God will bring constraint to live now in a life that pleases him, yes. But it's not by that life of pleasing him that I earn my way with him, that I'm in favour with him, that I somehow make it with him. He says, no, I've done it for you. I've sent my son to die in your place, to take upon himself all that your negativity actually deserves. He's sucked it into himself, suffered the consequences in your place by dying on a cross, so that you can have all the goodness that attracted to him in life eternal with the Father. That is an extraordinary message that's unique in all the religions. And it might be that it's not reincarnation that's attracted you. It might be that it's religiosity that's attracted you. It's the rules and regulations that you've been bound and enslaved to. We want to draw you to the wonderful news that there's actually mercy and forgiveness and life that's empowering and enriching, found by the gift of God, given by grace in Jesus. Let me almost finish with the words of a surprising advocate, and then we'll stop. Words of Bono. Has anyone not heard of the man Bono? U2 was a somewhat famous band a few years ago, and Bono was the lead singer. Listen to this. It comes from an interview that he gave a few years ago now. You can chase it up yourself. Listen to what he says. It's a mind-blowing concept that the God who created the universe might be looking for company, a real relationship with people. That is a mind-blowing concept. But the thing that keeps me on my knees is the difference between grace and karma. You see, at the center of all religions is the idea of karma. You know, what you put out comes back to you, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. It's clear to me that karma is at the very heart of the universe. I'm absolutely sure of it. And I think he's right. Astonishing. I think he's right. And yet along comes this idea called grace, to upend all of that as you reap, so you sow stuff. Grace defies reason and logic. Love interrupts, if you like, the consequences of your actions, which in my case is very good news indeed, because I've done lots of stupid stuff. I'd be in big trouble if karma was going to finally be my judge. I'd be in deep, and then I think he sins right at that point, but anyway. I'd be in big trouble if karma was going to finally be my judge. It doesn't excuse my mistakes, but I'm holding out for grace. And listen to this. I'm holding out that Jesus took my sins onto the cross because I know who I am, and I hope I don't have to depend on my religiosity. The point of the death of Christ is that Christ took on the sins of the world, so that what we put out did not come back to us, and that our sinful nature does not reap the obvious death. That's the point. It should keep us humble. It's not our good works that get us through the gates of heaven. Isn't that astonishing? Astonishing that he said it. But astonishing as a truth, and it is. It's a wonderful truth and insight into the reality of what the Bible teaches in the person of Jesus. Friends, he doesn't come with this set of rules that if you can keep them, you might somehow make it. You'll attract good if you do good. He doesn't come saying that. He says you're lost if that's the case. He comes seeking and searching after the lost, who have got ourselves in a distant land, having pursued all the things that were good pursuits, but only to find that we are totally destroyed by them. And he comes looking for us. That's the God of the Bible, who wants relationship with you, has paid a price so that you can have it with him by his grace and enjoy richness and fullness of life. It takes, though, a decision that you need to make to come and experience this. It's not the decision of deciding to keep a bunch of rules. You need to make a decision to humble yourself. I need to make that decision and see sense. And so come back and say to the God who has given us so much, I'm sorry. I cast you as one kind of God you're not, or I cast you off in the pursuit of reincarnation. Whatever it is, I realize I'm sorry. I've come to my senses. Please forgive me. That's just the expectation of relationship. Come back to God, and God, when he hears that, is full of gladness and rejoices and welcomes you. How about I pray? Great God and Heavenly Father, we thank you so much that you have come for us. You have sent your Son. We thank you that you have not left us in the distant land, lost in our own foolishness. We thank you that you are the Father of Jesus' story, full of grace and compassion and love, that you desire relationship, and you've made that relationship possible through your own efforts in the sacrifice of your Son on our behalf, who attracted to himself our sin, that we might be forgiven of it. And we thank you for that work and pray, please, this morning that you would help us come to our senses. It might be that you find us this morning as people pursuing reincarnation and the kind of hope of life and freedom that that brings. Please help us come to our senses and come back to you. It might be that you find us this morning as people, the objects of that initial story, religious people who are full of our own goodness. Help us come to our senses and see the need for the forgiveness and grace and mercy that you have won for us in Jesus. Please bring us back. In Jesus' name, amen.